Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by taking a look at bankruptcy. Declaring bankruptcy, of course, it's never an easy decision, and whether you do or you don't, the consequences for you and your finances can last a pretty long time. And luckily, we have an expert with us today to talk about the whole process. David Kreckler has 27 years of experience as an attorney, specializes in debtor, creditor, and bankruptcy cases, founding attorney of Kreckler Law in Madison. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about debt or money management and bankruptcy? Give a call, the number 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. David, thank you for joining us.
It's really a pleasure for me to be here, Larry. I've been a longtime WPR fan and listener. I do have to correct you, though. I wish I'd only been out of school 27 years. It's actually 46 years I've been doing this.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's a long, long time. And, you know, I bet over the years, you probably have not run into very many people who really wanted to go into bankruptcy. Maybe they were forced into it. I mean, and I was thinking about, why do people file bankruptcy? What kinds of conditions result in it? The first thing that came to my head was medical expenses. So, and that's probably one of the top reasons.
It is certainly a reason, and there have been studies that look at medical debt, but I think they're a little flawed. I would say that bankruptcy is usually caused by some catalyst, that loss of a job,
yeah,
or a divorce,
yeah,
or an injury or illness, usually resulting in lack of employment. Usually there's some catalyst. People try their best to deal with their financial problems, and they do whatever they can to avoid bankruptcy, often, yeah, to their own peril. I find that people will borrow money at rates they shouldn't. They will borrow from friends. They'll tap retirement sources. And I jokingly say they'll rob a convenience store, and only then will they come see a lawyer like me. We could do a lot more good for people if they saw us earlier, because they have a lot more options.
Yeah, I suppose. What does it really mean to be in personal bankruptcy?
It really has far fewer negative implications for most people than we all think.
Okay.
Before I started doing bankruptcy work, I knew very little about it. But if you think back, when you play Monopoly, there's a community chess card.
Yeah.
Says, go bankrupt, pay $10. And the little guy with the Mr. Monopoly standing there with his pockets empty, and he's paying $10. So bankruptcy must be terrible, right? You have nothing, your pockets are empty, and it costs money. Well, it's true, but very few people lose assets in bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is designed, it's a social pact that we made in this country. At one time, we had debtor's prison into the 1800s. And finally, we decided, well, this is not a good deal for society.
Yeah.
If we put you in prison because you owe money, we have to house you, feed you, you're not paying taxes. And so we said, we'll let you file bankruptcy, but you have to do two things. One, you have to give a full and complete financial disclosure. And number two, you have to surrender any assets that either Congress or the state legislature are not protected. We call that exempt property. But in reality, it turns out that well over 90% of people that file lose no assets, because everything they have is either exempt or it's fully encumbered. So you have a house worth $300, but you owe $320 on your mortgage. That's not going to be liquidated because there's no money that would come from that to go to creditors.
So people typically wouldn't lose their house?
Very few people lose their homes due to a bankruptcy. They might lose it due to a foreclosure, because bankruptcy doesn't get you a free house. You still have to pay your mortgage if you want to keep it. But it's extremely unlikely that you lose your home in a bankruptcy case.
What about credit? I mean, does it ruin your credit?
No and yes. You and I are old enough to know, or maybe remember, that at one time, bankruptcy carried a horrible stigma, both socially and in the credit world. So back in the late 80s, it would have been very difficult to get a car loan following a bankruptcy. Today, there are actually, there's a whole market. So many people have filed bankruptcy that there's a whole market where you, I can get a client a car loan almost automatically. It's not quite as easy to get. Now, those people are going to pay a high interest rate for their car loan.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not quite as easy to get a home mortgage, at least not through conventional sources. I usually tell people following a bankruptcy, to get a conventional mortgage, you probably need to wait 2 or 3 years.
What about the person who says, gosh, if I do it, then everybody's going to know that I filed?
That is a major impediment to people filing. That I mentioned the social stigma.
Yeah.
And in our country, we have stigmas that change over time with things like gambling and bankruptcy. The social stigma is far less today than it was 40 years ago. The bankruptcy code that we operate under today came into existence in 1978. And bankruptcy filings started skyrocketing after that. And we averaged 1 million filings a year over the next 40 years. And a lot of those filings are joint, meaning husband and wife. And so there were well over 40 million people that filed. And what happens is the more people that file, the less of a stigma there is, because when you know someone who's filed and you know that they're good people, that does, that usually removes or certainly mitigates against the negative stigma that existed.
What about your employer? Let's say I file for bankruptcy and, well, I don't think it's going to happen here, but let's say I did and Sarah Ashworth says, well, Larry filed for bankruptcy. I think I'm going to have to fire him.
She can't. At least not on those.
I don't think she'd want to.
No, I don't either. Not on those grounds. It's illegal. It's in the bankruptcy code. It's against federal law to discriminate based on solely on a bankruptcy filing. Of course, if you had a labor lawyer here, they would tell you that if an employer wants to get rid of you, they will find a way. But no, the only time that employment enters into it, a lot of people think that'll happen, that their employer will care. Usually they don't, nor should they. The only time I've really encountered problems over the years with people in the military are high security clearances.
There,
you can understand why that might be an issue.
Yeah, that makes some sense. You mentioned spouses and joint filing of bankruptcy. If you're married, typically I would expect that they both file at the same time, or do they have to?
They do not have to. You can only file a joint petition, which is the paperwork that starts a bankruptcy, if you're married. But there can be strategic reasons. There can be credit reasons for people not to file together. I will warn them that there are some, can be complications with a what we call a single spouse filing. So it has to be looked at carefully. If you're going to file your own bankruptcy, which more and more people are doing, especially now with AI, be careful of doing a single spouse filing until you really do your homework.
Our guest today, David Krackler, an attorney who specializes in debtor, creditor, and bankruptcy cases through his Madison business firm, Krackler Law. It's great to have him with us. And questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could send an email. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking bankruptcy today with David Krackler, attorney specializing in these kinds of cases through his Madison-based law firm, by the way. It's Krackler Law SC. And I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along today. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Peter in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
We live in a condominium that's about 40 years old, and it was built with a lifetime warranty on the roof. Well, our roof has started to fail, some of the tiles, and we went back to the company. They said, oh, that company has gone bankrupt. And but we could sell you the tiles, and it turns out it's the same company. And what we had heard is that companies, if they face liabilities, create a company, shift the liabilities to the company, and then, you know, bankrupt that company and relieve themselves of liability. Is this true, and is there any recourse?
It is true, and there is recourse. The devil is always in the details in something like this. So you would want to have someone or you take a very, very careful look at your warranty and who the parties are to it. And then you probably would have to investigate the transfer that occurred. It is not possible to just transfer liabilities in and of themselves. There is a whole body of law that we deal with quite a bit, actually. It's probably one of the principal sources of litigation in bankruptcy courts is things called fraudulent transfers. So when people transfer assets or liability with intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors, that does constitute a fraudulent or can constitute a fraudulent transfer, and the remedy is that it can be undone. So, Peter, you would want to take a good look at what happened. But yes, companies do try to accomplish what you're saying, and we can all understand why they would like to not have those liabilities. But it'll require a detailed investigation whether or not the amount you have involved justifies spending the legal fees may be a problem for you. That's a problem in all areas of the law, though, is that it's often expensive.
Well, so you'd have to have somebody going looking through all of the paperwork of that company, I would guess.
Yeah, but if you sued them, you are in bankruptcy. Well, have they filed bankruptcy, Peter?
This happened some time ago. Apparently that the company bankrupted that sort of.
I got it. Yeah. So they did it several years back.
It may be too late for that. There are statutes of limitation on fraudulent transfers. Usually, they vary under Wisconsin law. It's Chapter 242 of the Wisconsin statutes, and generally, it's 4 years. Bankruptcy, if I said earlier, there are two requirements to get a discharge, and one is a full disclosure. So one good thing about bankruptcy, if you're an aggrieved party, like it sounds like you are, Peter, is that during the bankruptcy, you have the opportunity to really dig in and get any information you want about the debtor.
Yeah, but if you don't know that the debtor filed for bankruptcy, then you're kind of...
Well, maybe. If you didn't know about the bankruptcy, if you didn't receive notice and you didn't have actual knowledge, you may still have rights to pursue it, because due process under the Constitution, not just in bankruptcy, but the law in general, requires that you be notified of things like that.
Okay, so you need to check back and ensure that you, one starting point, I think, would be, hey, did we ever get a notice that the original company filed for bankruptcy?
Yeah, I think so. And if that company, if you're saying that company still exists, the discovery, this ability to get information, isn't just in bankruptcy. You could bring a small claims action if your claim is under $10,000 and get discovery that way. You're allowed to serve them, put them under oath, request documents, make them answer questions under oath. A lot of things you can do.
Yeah. In about 40 minutes from now, we'll be talking about small claims courts. So that's our next topic coming up after this one, David and Peter. All right, some things to think about there, Peter. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Sky in Madison next. Hi, Sky.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I am a student at UW. I'm in grad school, and I was just wondering if there's any things students need to know with, you know, bankruptcy and how that can affect student loans. My mom told me that there's nothing like bankruptcy doesn't help with student loans, but since it's on the topic on the air today, I thought I would call in and get some information on if that's true or not.
Yeah, that's a good question.
It is, and it's timely. And for many years, almost all bankruptcy lawyers advised people filing bankruptcy not to even bother trying to discharge their student loan. So you got to break your student loans into federal and private, and they're quite different. If your loan is federal, you have a much better chance of discharging it in a bankruptcy. However, Sky, you sound young and you're a grad student, so you probably are fairly young. And it makes it difficult for young people to discharge loans because the theory or premise behind student loans is that you're investing in your future and you're going to pay this back with future earnings. However, since November of 2022, we have had very good success at discharging student loans for the right kind of people. I can tell you that my firm has a 100% success rate in either discharging the entire student loan or the majority of it for the people for whom we sued the federal government, so this is only federal loans, to try and discharge the loan. The reason for that is that the Department of Education issued guidance to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is where the attorneys are who litigate these matters in bankruptcy court for the Department of Education. And the guidance instructed U.S. attorneys to look at certain factors, and if they were met by the debtor, to stipulate that the debt was dischargeable. Otherwise, it is very difficult to demonstrate the three requirements for discharging a student loan. One is the first is that your situation is such that if you had to pay the student loan, you could not maintain a minimal standard of living. The second is that this condition is likely to persist for a long time or the majority of the balance of the loan term. And the third is that the debtor has made reasonable efforts to try and pay. Those can be very, very difficult. Some courts have said that it requires a certainty of hopelessness. But under this guidance, if you are below median income and the median for a one-person household right now, it changes due to inflation, but right now it's about $65,000 in Wisconsin. The likelihood of it continuing, if you were over age 65, there's a presumption of that. It can also be a presumption if you have chronic health issues. There's a number of different factors. Yeah. I won't go through all of them. And then the third prong, the effort to pay, really all you have to do is contact the servicer and you've satisfied that prong. But I suspect that you are going to be too young for this to be a good remedy for you.
Yeah. Well, Sky, there you go. Lots to think about, though, as you go on through your education. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dave in Whitehall, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dave.
Hey. I don't know how to word this correctly, but back in 2009, we filed a Chapter 9 for some medical bills.
Yeah.
And then a little while later, we got this thing in the mail that said we had to start paying it back, but I think it was some kind of collection agency, but I never signed or agreed to anything. So we've been paying it. And now with our first mortgage, I got a thing where the company changed its name and I never signed nothing with them. Do I have to do that? And then I've been seeing out on social media that, I don't know, there's some way you ask for certain things that you can. If they can't supply what you asked for, you don't have to pay back the stuff from the bankruptcy. Is that true?
Okay. You got a lot there, Dave. Let me try and hit them in order. First, you did not file a Chapter 9. That would require you to be a municipality. So you probably didn't do that. You probably filed a Chapter 7.
Seven, I bet.
Which is the most popular form of bankruptcy. About 60% of all cases filed, both nationally and in Wisconsin, are Chapter 7. A Chapter 7 case is over and done with in less than 4 months. Is that what yours was?
Yeah, it might have took a little bit longer than that. I'm not sure.
But it didn't last 3 to 5 years, because if it did that, you would have been in a Chapter 13, which makes up the other 40% of cases. So you may say, well, that's 100%. What about this Chapter 9 you just mentioned? And what about Chapter 11 and Chapter 12 and Chapter 15? All of those cases, while they get a lot of news, because Chapter 11 is often big business, like General Motors, Chrysler, Airlines, they make up in volume a very, very small slice, less than 1% of all cases filed. If you listed that medical bill, and even if you didn't, you probably should not be paying that. And if you have been paying, you might be able to get that money back. I just recovered over $23,000 for a client from the Wisconsin Department of Revenue who was collecting after a bankruptcy filing. So it is possible to get that money. If I were you, if you had an attorney in your case, I would contact that lawyer and tell that lawyer what is happening, because you should not have to pay for that. Your third question about the mortgage, I don't know if I fully understand it, but it is quite common that mortgages are sold and assigned. Both the owner of the note and mortgage and the servicers change all the time. They're required to notify you if that happens.
Sure, they would have to require that. They would have to do that, I would expect.
But it's very common. My own home mortgage probably was sold 3 times.
Wow. So does that help, Dave?
My question was, wouldn't they have to send me something that I sign and agree to?
Not for them to assign the mortgage. If you go and dig out your folder and buried in some desk drawer from your closing and you read all the fine print, you'll see that you cannot assign your rights, but the lender typically can. That would be pretty standard.
That would be pretty standard. All right. There you go, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Jamie emailed and says, David, you use the term unencumbered. What does that mean, and how does it relate to filing bankruptcy?
Well, first, I apologize for using a legalese word. I shouldn't do that. So an encumbrance is a lien. So I mentioned my home mortgage.
Yeah.
My house is my asset. It is encumbered by the mortgage on my house. So that is what an encumbrance is. It is some lien. And when we try to look at equity that we might have, so if you're looking at your home equity in your house, you take the value of the house and subtract your mortgage or mortgages, if you have more than one, and then you would subtract any other liens like a tax lien or a judgment lien in order to determine the equity that you have. And all of those liens are encumbrances.
So if you had a $300,000 house, let's say, and you still owed $150,000 on it, that would be the value of the house then would be that you'd be figuring would be the 150.
And the encumbrance under your example, Larry, would also be 150.
Okay. All right. So there we go. Eric in Madison emailed to ask, how does bankruptcy work during divorce proceedings, especially when child support and legal fees are involved? And I know in your book, we should have mentioned it earlier, it's titled Bankruptcy Asked and Answered by David Kreckler. You do talk about divorce and family issues in that book.
And they go hand in hand quite a bit. I give a number of seminars every year to lawyers, judges, court commissioners on this topic. Sometimes we sort of tongue-in-cheek call it the happiness package, bankruptcy and divorce combined. They can be complicated. So I can tell you with what you mentioned, Eric, child support is never dischargeable in bankruptcy, never, nor is any sort of maintenance which used to be called alimony in Wisconsin. We call it maintenance. Other debts, so if you were going through a divorce and you're ordered to pay the MasterCard bill, that might be dischargeable, but only in a Chapter 13 case. So that's part of what I do as part of my profession, is I analyze people's situations and determine what the goals are, what are we trying to do, and how are we going to achieve those goals. And bankruptcy is a tool. Larry mentioned earlier the reluctance of people to file, and I understand that, but it really should be viewed as a tool. And not only is it a tool, but bankruptcy, the analogy would be a wrench. You don't just have a wrench, you have all kinds of wrenches in your toolbox, and bankruptcy is the same way. So sometimes we use a 7, sometimes a 13, and a 13, there can be a strategic reason to use it in a divorce context. The legal fees may or may not be dischargeable. We'd have to dig in there. It would depend what those fees were incurred, who incurred them, and for what purpose.
Vivian in Green Bay has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Vivian, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I recently saw a report about zombie mortgages. And in essence, it might be a second, even a third mortgage that had been resold at a time when mortgage holders weren't making profits, so they never serviced that mortgage. And then when they became more profitable and people had not remembered or had thought it had been discharged somehow, the zombie mortgage comes back to life at higher rates with higher fees, and homes are foreclosed upon. What can you tell us about those?
Oh, interesting.
And they're becoming quite common. I don't want to say common. It's not like we're all going to run into them. But yeah. I will tell you that I have 3 or 4 of these cases right now I'm working on.
So what happens? Explain again. Vivian started and I think did a good job, but just so people know.
She did, with only 1-2 corrections. So what happened was there were bankruptcies filed during the recession between 2008, 2012, could be later.
Yeah.
But at that time, there was no equity. Remember the encumbrances. So let's go back to your example, Larry, of a $300,000 home with that $150,000 first mortgage. But then there's a second mortgage for $200,000. Okay? So there's no equity. And the debtor may have filed a bankruptcy, may not have. But the second mortgage holder didn't really want to do anything. It works better if we say the first ate up all the equity by itself.
Yeah.
So a $300,000 home with a $300,000 first, and there's still a second mortgage. The second mortgage holder doesn't want to foreclose because there's no equity for it to get any money. But what's happened over the last 10, 12 years, the homeowner has paid down the first mortgage, so it's been creating equity, and the values of properties have gone up over all that time. So now there's a lot of equity in the home. The second mortgage holder, Vivian, in your example, probably has not been doing anything to try and collect. And now that there's a lot of equity, they're coming out of the woodwork saying, hey, we have this mortgage, you better pay us. And the statute of limitations, they may not be able to sue you and get a judgment because the statute of limitations, which is the amount of time that a creditor has to sue, is only 6 years, but that's on a money judgment. The statute of limitations to enforce a mortgage in Wisconsin is 30 years.
Oh.
So they can sit back for a long time and then come, and we are seeing these now. Now, you mentioned, Vivian, higher rates. They cannot change the rate. The rate is what the rate was, and you dig up your mortgage loan documents, and whatever that rate is, whatever's in your contract is what it still is, and the same is also true of fees. Now, the average person will think that this is really unjust and unfair, but if you look at it from the creditor's perspective, they're going to say, hey, you've had the use of this money all these years, you haven't been paying us. For all we know, you've invested that in the stock market and done very, very well. So there are two sides to these issues. But you, I suspect, but there are also tricks, there are strategies that you can employ to maybe even get rid of that zombie mortgage, or at the very least, be able to negotiate a substantial discount. It'll depend upon your circumstances.
What kind of, what would be an example of a kind of trick that you could do?
Well, let's say that you had your father. Well, there's several things. You could threaten them with a bankruptcy themselves, and we're going to pay you, but we're going to pay you spread out over time. So whenever you can threaten a creditor with being paid over time instead of being paid today, you have some leverage for negotiations. So that'd be an easy one.
Oh, that okay. So, once again, you really need, I'm thinking you need an attorney who is skilled in these kinds of situations, or
That's probably true for almost everything in the law, not just my field of practice, but just about everything.
What's a typical, somebody in a position like yours that does this kind of work, typically is it an hourly rate, or are they rates that are, you know, for the person who's hiring somebody, is it hourly, is it, here's what I'm going to charge you kind of thing?
It's going to depend upon the type of case. So if you have a very simple case, you have some credit card debt, maybe a car loan. There are firms out there, sometimes we call them bankruptcy mills because they just pump out bankruptcy cases. Usually can tell who they are because they do a lot of advertising. So if it's a routine case, it's somewhat of a commodity, and that lends itself to flat fees.
Got it.
So I can do your case for $3,000.
Yeah.
And if you know, if the lawyer knows what's going to be there, that's easy to do. Most of my practice involves small businesses and farms. Far more difficult because I do a lot of reorganizations under some of those chapters that without the high volume, but they're important cases, 12 and 11. So I do almost all my work hourly. I think that's more fair to people because if I had to charge a flat rate, I'd have to make it high enough to cover any contingencies. And the more complicated a case is, the more things might happen. So you can shop around depending on your case. I would never tell someone to shop for the cheapest lawyer, just like I wouldn't want to shop for the cheapest heart surgeon.
Yeah, that's for sure. A listener emailed to say that a year ago they had a spinal fusion and has been paying $100 monthly for it. Haven't missed a payment. Nevertheless, this person was sent to collection because the bill has not been paid off in 15 months. Should the listener pay the collection agency or continue to pay the medical facility itself? And if the listener pays the collection agency, does that hurt their credit score?
So the question I want to ask back to the listener is, are you just paying the $100 a month? Did you set that amount, or is that an agreement you had with the creditor? If it's an agreement with the creditor, hopefully you have it in writing, and that would, even if you don't, you probably could enforce that. If you're just deciding on your own, I can afford $100 a month, that's what I'm going to pay, the creditor is not bound by that. Medical creditors, however, in my experience, are among the least aggressive. It doesn't mean they won't eventually enforce their rights, but they're usually among the least aggressive creditors. So you didn't say how big your bill is. If it's substantial, and I don't know much about spinal fusions, but it sounds like it could be very, very expensive. If that's the case, then I would suggest you do call someone and find out what your options are for dealing with this.
Yeah, I'm thinking, does he pay the, or does he or she, do they pay the, just continue to pay the medical facility, but would it pay to send the collection agency a note and saying, I'm continuing to pay the hospital this bill?
Depending on what it is you want to do, dealing with the, sending it to collection is not necessarily a bad thing for you. Because most collection agencies are working on a contingent fee. And so they want to churn this account over. And so they're interested in getting a quick resolution, Not that they don't want to get more money, too, but they want to get a quick resolution. So if bankruptcy is not an option, by the way, there are other non-bankruptcy options. If you owed, I'm going to make this up, if you owed $3,600, you could pay $100 a month under a procedure under Wisconsin law called Chapter 128. Even though it has the word chapter in front of it, it's not a bankruptcy. But Chapter 128 allows you to pick your debts. I'm generalizing because naturally it's more complicated. But you can select which creditors you want to pay and pay them interest-free over 36 months. So if you only owed $3,600, you could pay $100 a month and you could force them to take that payment. If I was unsure about the credibility of this collection agency, I want to verify it with the creditor before I start sending money.
Yeah. So you could go to the hospital and say, hey, look, did you turn this over to a collection agency?
Yes.
What's the history of this agency? Or
yes, you could.
All right. Our guest today, David Kreckler, attorney, specializes in debtor, creditor, and bankruptcy cases through his Madison-based firm, Kreckler Law. Questions for him. He has some good questions, as all we always do here on WPR News. You can join in, too, or maybe an experience to share. Love to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. This afternoon, Jill Nadeau and I are going to jump in the car and head to Eau Claire. And tonight, we'll be at the Pablo Center at 7 o'clock, and we'll be reminiscing a bit and talking about my time here, well, and her time, too, at WPR. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I've mentioned a couple times we were in Wausau and just had a great time, and now we're in Eau Claire. Tonight at 7 o'clock at the Pablo Center. And I think there's still a way for you to get in. If you want to get in, go to WPR.org/presents and just sign up. It's free. But we just need to know a little bit so we can provide enough swag and cookies and whatever else we're gonna have. It's going to be a lot of fun. 7 o'clock tonight in Eau Claire. And right now, though, we're talking about bankruptcy with David Kreckler, specializes in debtor, creditor, and bankruptcy cases. His business's firm is Kreckler Law SC. And questions for him, give a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Nathan from Cooksville emailed. He wants to know how filing bankruptcy affects your ability to apply for credit cards.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the credit stigma.
Yeah.
And at one time, that would have been a no-no. You wouldn't have been able to get it. Now, almost anyone can get a credit card after a bankruptcy. Even in the worst possible scenario, Nathan, you should be able to get what's called a secured card. So you give them a $300 deposit and you have $300 available on your credit line. A number of those companies will allow you, provided you pay on time for a year, they'll convert you to a regular card. Credit card policies change over time. At one time, Capital One, what's in your wallet, used to, we would file a bankruptcy and they would send my clients offers for new credit cards while they were still in bankruptcy. Now, they haven't been doing that lately, but these policies evolve and change all the time. But certainly, it is a lot easier to get a credit card now. I don't know that I have a client who can't get one.
And, you know, the thing you mentioned, even if it's for a small amount, I think it's worth it to have a credit card as long as you make the payments, because you're building your credit standing back up, aren't you?
That's correct. And that's one of the things we try to do for people is when we finish and send a bankruptcy case is over, we try to give them some advice about how to go forward in the best way. And I think it is good. Credit scores are, in my personal opinion, overrated. They're really not as important as the credit industry would like us to believe. You really only need your credit score a few times in your life when you're buying a house or a car or insurance. But still, they are important, and there are things you can do. The largest portion, the plurality of your credit score is made up by your payment history. So you're absolutely right. Getting a card and maintaining that a good payment history is a really good way to improve your credit scores. There are studies that show that people who went through a Chapter 7 bankruptcy have a higher credit score and more access to credit 18 months after a bankruptcy than they did 18 months before. So bankruptcy is not a death knell to credit.
I just got my score. It's 829 from I just learned. So that's pretty, I'm not going to have to worry too much about it.
All the listeners are going to be calling asking you to help co-sign.
Oh, man. And here the previous listener, the fellow who was, or gal, I'm not sure who, was calling and paying $100 a month, and then the collection agency was after him. They had $2,800 left to pay, and they'd been paying $100 a month.
I don't know why the creditor would want to bother if they're getting $100 a month. That seems silly to me. But you could threaten them with that Chapter 128 proceeding, and they would get less than $100 a month, and they have no say in that.
The hospital itself or the credit agent?
The hospital. Collection agency really doesn't have standing to decide what you do.
So it would make sense to call the hospital and say, what the heck? You turned this over to a credit agency. I only owe you $2,800 and I'm paying $100 a month.
I agree.
Yeah, definitely in that situation, I think that doesn't make much sense to me why they'd turn it over to a credit agency.
Nor to me.
And another question in email, in a bankruptcy, when would the court order the sale of assets to pay creditors?
So at the outset, I mentioned the two requirements to get a bankruptcy discharge, a full disclosure and a surrender of any non-exempt assets. Wisconsin, like all states, allows its residents to keep certain kinds and types of property up to certain values. And that applies to all of us, you, me, Larry.
Yeah.
Even as we sit here, there are things that creditors can't take away from us. In bankruptcy in Wisconsin, not in all states, but here, we get to choose whether to use the Wisconsin exemptions that I just referred to or whether we want to use a set of federal exemptions that exist under the bankruptcy code. So we get to pick. Not all states allow that. If you have assets that do not fall within the category of the exemptions you're choosing, then those are supposed to be surrendered in a Chapter 7 case to the Chapter 7 trustee for liquidation and distribution of the proceeds to the creditors. In a Chapter 13, and I mentioned earlier that there are strategic reasons to use a Chapter 13, one might be divorce, but this is another one. If you want to keep non-exempt assets, you can keep them in a Chapter 13 and pay for them spread out over 5 years, so you don't have to give them up.
I'm trying to remember this, and it's and you may have even mentioned it. I didn't catch it. Means testing. Is that kind of what you were talking about there?
No, the means testing has been around since 2005. It was the result of a more than a decade-long lobbying effort by primarily the credit card industry to make bankruptcy more difficult. There was a perception in some areas that people who filed bankruptcy were fraudulent and a lot of people were filing who didn't need to. My personal experience is that doesn't happen. 10 to 1, the number of people crying in my office because they have to file bankruptcy to the number of people who somehow are trying to game the system. But anyhow, the law changed in 2005, and Congress says that if you make too much money, you shouldn't get a Chapter 7 discharge. You should go into Chapter 13. So the means test compares the debtor's household income, gross household income, to the median household income for a household of that size. Remember earlier I said the median income for a household of one is $65,000. So if I were filing bankruptcy, if my income is below $65,000, I immediately pass the means test and I can go to Chapter 7. If I'm above $65,000, I have to go through about a seven-page form of a bunch of deductions to see if I qualify under the means test. Now, if I do, Chapter 7 is still my option. If I'm above that number and I don't pass, then the U.S. government, which is represented in bankruptcy by an organization called the United States Trustee, they're an arm of the Department of Justice, they will come in and try to push me into Chapter 13. The means test is also used in Chapter 13 to determine what amount of money I should be paying each month. We call it monthly disposable income. What amount of money should I be paying each month to my unsecured creditors?
Oh.
So the means test is a very, very important piece of bankruptcy. Not so much for people if you're below median. No problem.
No problem.
But when you're starting to deal with people who make a lot of money, the means test becomes very, very important. I once represented a neurosurgeon making over $90,000 a month, and it was a challenge to get him into Chapter 7.
But you got him into Chapter 7?
And we got him a discharge.
Wow. I'm wondering, how unusual is it for an individual to file for bankruptcy more than once?
Probably more common than you might think. I don't know the statistics, but anecdotally, I know how many of my clients come back. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And it isn't necessarily a bad thing. So I want you to think Walt Disney, Heinz the ketchup guy, JCPenney, Henry Ford, all of them had businesses, multiple businesses that failed before they hit struck on the business. Yes, the business that we all know them for. So if we're thinking entrepreneurs who are trying to go out there and create jobs and wealth, I'm not necessarily opposed to recidivist bankruptcies. I think the system is designed for that. We want to encourage entrepreneurship. On the other hand, there are some people, hopefully not many, who just aren't very good with credit. And I already told you that it's not that hard to get credit after bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So if you go through a bankruptcy, you're not good with credit, and you go through a bankruptcy and you still can get it, you may end up being a recidivist.
I was thinking about my own score, which is pretty good, but I many, many, many years ago, I just made my decision that any credit card, I was in a little deep, I've got it paid off. And I made the rule to myself I would never run a balance. And I don't run it. Sometimes it hurts, but
it's a good way to live.
I think it's been a pretty good way for me to live anyway.
It'll certainly reduce your stress level.
And raise your credit score too. There you go. David, we've got plenty more we could talk about. You've done a wonderful job. Thank you so much.
Well,
for being with us today. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did as well.
Thank you for having me.
David Kreckler is an attorney specializing in debtor-creditor and bankruptcy cases through his Madison business, and it's a firm. He's a lawyer. Kreckler Law SC. It's great to have him with us. And we're going to be talking to some more lawyers coming up. We'll take a look at small claims court. Have you ever been to small claims court? What happened? Maybe you're thinking about going to small claims court. What do you need to know? We'll get answers to those questions next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.